Okay, then we proceed with Vice. And I suppose I give the floor to Uni or to Rihanna?
Uni. So, good afternoon, board members. The objective of the session today is to provide the board with the summary of feedback received on the FICE discussion paper, both through the comment letters and outreach undertaken by board members and the staff. At this meeting, we will cover the classification sections of the discussion paper summarized in agenda paper 5A to 5E. And at the next board meeting, we plan to cover the remaining sections of the discussion paper, which will include the feedback on the overall objective, scope, and what respondents suggested as the project direction. And that would conclude our feedback summary. As we stated in our cover paper, at this meeting, we are not asking the board to make any decisions. We plan to complete our feedback summary before asking the board to decide on the project direction. And if board members agree, we would like to tee up our papers in three parts, 5A, B, and C together, which covers the feedback on the classification of non-derivative and derivatives, and then separately 5E, which covers 5D, which covers compound instrument and redemption obligation, and then 5E, which covers the putable exception and IFRIC 2 instruments. Are board members happy with that? Great. And before we tee up the paper, there's one point we would like to clarify. In some agenda papers, we used an expression that few respondents said certain comments. And what we meant there is to flag that a handful of respondents, or slightly more, made that particular comment. We did not mean to imply that everyone but few said the opposite. So apologies if that has caused any confusion. So with that, Lira will tee up the first three papers.
Thank you. Agenda paper 5A summarizes the feedback from comment letters and outreach on the board's preferred approach to classification of financial instruments. As set out in the discussion paper, the board's preferred approach to classification is based on the timing feature described as an obligation to transfer economic resources at a specified time other than at liquidation, and the amount feature representing the obligation for an amount independent of the entity's available economic resources. The key messages from feedback on this approach included: most respondents supported the board's decision to continue the binary distinction between liabilities and equity. Almost all respondents were supportive of the timing feature, but most of them disagreed or expressed concerns with the way the amount feature is applied in the board's preferred approach. The concerns expressed related to the underlying notion of the amount feature itself, its practical implications, as well as the clarity of such notion. As described in paragraphs 15 to 17 of Agenda Paper 5A, one of the primary concerns related to financial instruments that contain obligations for an independent amount payable only on liquidation of the entity. Applying the amount feature, these instruments would be classified as financial liabilities, either in part or wholly, whereas many of them are currently classified as equity, applying IAS 32. While the concerns were expressed from different angles, for example, consistency with the going concern assumption, its relevance to solvency assessment, and the practical implications arising from classification changes, many of these concerns came down to the classification change for obligations that only arise on liquidation. In addition, as summarized in paragraphs 18 to 24 of this paper, many respondents raised comments about the interaction between the conceptual framework and the discussion paper. Many respondents asked the board to explain the rationale for what they consider as diverting from the conceptual framework, but a few specifically observed that the board's preferred approach to classification should be more closely aligned with the conceptual framework. Most respondents also expressed concerns about the new terminology. For example, independent amount, entities available economic resources. The underlying reasons included increased implementation costs and the need to apply judgment, which in turn may lead to new interpretation issues and diversity in accounting practice. Few respondents suggested classification approaches for the board to consider as an alternative to the board's preferred approach, and these are summarized in paragraph 43 of agenda paper 5A. To illustrate the concerns with the amount feature, many respondents provided examples of non-derivative financial instruments for which classification would change from equity to financial liabilities if the board's preferred approach were to be implemented. The most common examples of such financial instruments and the feedback from respondents are summarized in agenda paper 5B. I'll now continue with the tee-up for agenda paper 5C. This paper summarizes the feedback on the board's preferred approach to classification of derivatives on own equity. Paragraphs 4 to 7 of the paper describe the proposals in discussion paper for classifying derivatives on own equity. In response to these proposals, most respondents agreed with the challenges identified by the board, noting that majority of the practice challenges with IAS 32 indeed relate to classification of derivatives on own equity, especially applying the fixed-for-fixed condition. Almost all respondents supported the board's proposal for derivative on own equity to be classified in its entirety, i.e., without separately classifying the individual legs of the exchange. Many respondents also agreed with the board that derivatives on own equity should be classified as equity instruments, financial assets, or financial liabilities, rather than all as financial assets or financial liabilities. However, a few respondents disagreed and expressed the view that derivatives on own equity should not be classified as equity prior to the actual delivery or receipt of the equity instruments. Many respondents were not supportive of the board's preferred approach to classification of derivatives on own equity. These respondents considered that this approach is more complex and requires more judgment compared to the existing requirements in IAS 32. Primarily, with respect to assessing whether or not the net amount is affected by a variable that is independent of the entity's available economic resources, which is required for the purpose of applying the amount feature. More than a few respondents, however, said that some existing practice challenges could be addressed if the board further developed some of the proposals in the discussion paper for derivatives on own equity. Acknowledging the challenges and widespread diversity in practice arising from application of fixed-for-fixed condition in IAS 32, a few respondents suggest that the board should seek to make improvements to this condition instead. A few other respondents suggested alternative approaches to classifying derivatives on own equity, which are summarized in paragraph 62 to 65 of agenda paper 5C. Finally, about one-third of respondents who provided feedback on this topic disagreed with the removal of the foreign currency rights issue exception for the reasons summarized in paragraphs 68 to 71 of this paper.
Okay.
I think we can hand over if there's any discussions or any questions.
Amaru.
Thanks, Liz. So my take is, just to confirm, so this is a summary of what we are going to see in more detail in other papers, right, at the end of the day as well. Because the comments, the feedback here, we are going to somewhat explore in more detail later on. Like, what I heard with more frequency when discussing this was about the liquidation that you mentioned and the going concern and versus conceptual framework. So, on the other hand, I heard quite a lot people saying that, well, something needs to be done. And that was my difficulty in discussing with people. Well, something needs to be done because in my particular jurisdiction, Brazil, this market stalled completely because the regulator has a view, and the regulator actually was very sympathetic to what we've proposed because in their understanding actually confirmed their view, although we said, well, this is not an interpretation of our IS 32. Mm-hmm. So then they started, well, if it's not an interpretation, are you going to develop a new standard? Mm-hmm. And so we, at least in this summary, it was not mentioned that if people was really into this route of a new standard instead of continue pursuing a clarification to provide a response to issues that are around the table in the Interpretation Committee for a couple of years. So how are you feeling about, well, it's nice to be almost the last meeting because I can. I was asked this last week by regulators, by auditors, by preparers. But how is the ISB going to, or is thinking about going ahead? Are you still in the route of, well, let's continue pursuing this clarification? Or are you already starting to feel that the comments might drive you to a complete review of IS-32. I said, well, we don't know yet. We are going to deliberate. But reading the summary and hearing you, it seems to be quite a lot.
Yes, so I think in terms of the direction, I think the question that you raised, Amara, is the question that we will be asking after completing our feedback summary, really, what the board should be doing. And in terms of the feedback that received on the overall direction of the project, our plan is to bring that together with the rest of the feedback on the remaining sections of the discussion paper at the next meeting, because we felt that it will be more useful for the board to have heard detailed comments about different sections of the discussion paper before hearing the feedback about the overall direction. So we plan to bring that at the next meeting, and we will ask the board that question after we have completed our feedback summary.
Thank you.
So unfortunately, Amaro, you don't get to talk about that anymore.
Nick has already suggested for me to go in the back. Raise my hand, and Nick. I can trick Neely.
So a few observations. So thank you for the summary. Interesting. I think a few of the comments that were raised on amount did make me pause and make me wonder what we could do with it. I think some of the points raised on some of the measurement issues that come up because of our focus on liquidation are good questions. And I think some of the points made around the clarity of our articulation and why we did things like sort of equate share price to residual were fair challenges. Mm-hmm. But the challenge, I think, for us is, I think it's hard. I find it difficult to articulate it better than we did in the discussion paper. I think the idea is the right one, but drafting it in a way that's not too circular is very challenging to do, and I didn't see anybody in the letters I looked at that came up with something magical that worked that I could see. In terms of some of the comments so those were the comments I sort of could see where they were coming from, and I thought they were fair. I think some of the things that maybe troubled me a little bit, just a flag for you guys to think about when you come back again with looking at the way forward. If you look at the comments on liquidation, I think the challenge that people raise about why are you suddenly obsessed about liquidation when we're meant to be doing going concern accounting, and how does that tie with the conceptual framework, is a fair caution to us. But on the flip side, what I found very interesting when I read the comment letters is the fact that a number of people who say don't focus on liquidation then quite quickly turn around and say, and these things should be considered to be equity because in liquidation they behave like equity, whereas in the normal course they always pay coupons and behave like debt. So don't focus on liquidation, but give me equity classification. But if they don't want me to focus on liquidation, then surely the fact they normally behave like debt should matter, but they don't want us to come to that conclusion. And I'm not quite sure how I connect the dots on those two arguments. The other things that caused me to pause quite a bit was that a lot of people say we should do something about fixed for fixed. If we do nothing else, I think everybody thinks we should do something about fixed for fixed in 32. And certainly having now understood what people are doing with fixed for fixed and have got comfortable with, I certainly think we need to do something about fixed for fixed in 32. But what surprised me was that there didn't seem to be an awful lot of comment about whether or not the amount thinking that we had would really assist in solving fixed for fixed. I got the sense a lot of people really wanted us to almost, and I'm exaggerating slightly, but almost start with what's normal in the market and say that's all okay for fixed and approach it that way, rather than coming at it from a conceptual basis. And I find that quite challenging, because then, and I think the challenge we have with fixed for fixed today in 32 is not just that the words can't be applied sensibly read literally, but also that there's no idea underpinning it to use as an anchor consistently when you apply those words. And if we start by saying let's go through what's normal in term sheets and tick all that off and make sure that's all covered, again we don't really have a basis for decisions, and as things morph over time what's going to happen. And if they didn't like the amount idea, they didn't seem to give me another idea to work with to solve fixed for fixed, even though I'd like to address it. And perhaps where that was the most apparent was in the reaction to foreign currency. Now, I understand loads of people would like foreign currency denominated derivatives to be capable of being classified as equity. I still thought that based on the ideas that we developed, where we got to on foreign currency was valid, given the logic. And the thing, again, that troubled me with this was the arguments that were raised for why we should get to equity classification weren't terribly compelling to me. So, for example, the fact that from a IFRS 9 perspective, you look at classification of an instrument in its own currency and therefore you should take the same approach when you get to IAS 32, I think it really is a bit cute, because it misses the point that if you're the issuer, this idea of residual or what's your equity is influenced by what your currency is. And what I'd really hope people would do, and I had a few conversations with people who were focusing on foreign currency and encouraged them to do it in their letters, but I didn't see any evidence of it, was try and help me understand how to think about currency better in a way that's conceptual, that makes me understand how to think about the residual thing in an entity so that I've got something to build my thinking from. But I didn't get that. I just got lots of people have to issue in a foreign currency, therefore it should be, you know, you should just bless it because it's normal. And that doesn't really give me a concept to build from. And so a number of those areas really, in combination with the feedback on clarity and articulation and the fair comments on linking to share price and things like that, leave me a little bit stuck in terms of what basis I've got to actually do much moving forward if you want me to bin the amount feature. And I found that quite a challenge when I read the letters.
Doug.
Thank you. The first key message in paragraph 6, we've got the support for our binary classification. I think it's natural, and we are happy with that. However, on the other hand, if I read it through, there are strong disagreement with our principle we proposed, especially the amount features. And there are lots of concern, both in conceptually basis and both in operational basis. And then binary approach would be nice, would provide good information if the classification, the principle is supported strongly and understood well. But if the classification principle was not strongly supported and not well understood, I wonder if the classification between equity and liability, the information value of that classification is not really variable. because people are not really supporting our classification principles. So in that case, I was wondering if there is any possibility that we should reconsider the classification other than binary approach. I mean, because if we stick to binary approach, we need to overcome lots of issues which was raised in this feedback. Then if we could do it, it's fine. But in the last minutes, if we couldn't really sort out everything in a timely manner, then I think if we could go back to the approach other than binary, and it may provide much more flexibility, and it could provide better information because we can stick to the more narrower definition of liability, which is completely consistent with conceptual framework. And also we can provide much stricter definition of equity, which everybody could agree with. And then there is somewhere in between. We may call it mezzanine or whatever. Then we can put the appropriate measurement basis for each individual financial instrument issued, rather than stick to the strict principle of a binary approach. So in the long run basis, not now, but in the future, please leave a room to come back to the classification other than binary approach.
Okay.
Less chairs, right?
Everything.
And I thought that was one of the few things that we got a clear answer for, yes. Namely, so, not to go there.
Yeah. I'm not saying.
It could be a way, but I don't think that's what we heard from the feedback received. Yeah.
Except from some small island very far away.
That's not New Zealand.
If I could make some general comments, which are mainly related to the sections that we're discussing today, and these comments aren't directed at the staff team, but they're things for us as an organisation to think about. And so there were five investor comment letters, all of which are from very highly respected investor groups. And amongst investors, these are some of the most sophisticated in terms of understanding financial reporting requirements. And I would say, having looked through those letters with care, there are two themes that come out of the letters. The first one, which you won't be surprised by, is complexity. So either our recommendations are too complex, and actually sometimes even too complex to understand the question that was being asked. They couldn't, which they write in the letters, like, we can't answer the question. And a couple of the groups just restrict themselves to the questions on presentation and disclosure, no more than that. And so I think that's a problem. So if the users can't understand what our proposed requirements are, I'm not sure how we progress that forward, to be honest. I think that's a real struggle. And partly in the response to that, and that's the second theme that came through, is many of them reverted to saying actually the way forward is better disclosures. That is the answer. And actually, if you give us those, we can actually analyse the instruments ourselves and reach our own conclusions rather than try and understand the various approaches the board came up with. I think those comments particularly relate to the sections that we're discussing today, but I think we need to think about those and how we address those.
On the investor point, what we plan to do is we also plan to bring a separate investor feedback paper at the next meeting. What we have done for this meeting is, because our outreach tended to focus on more on presentation and disclosure proposal, because that's what investors really were more interested. A lot of the comments from investors related to that section. So what we have done for this classification paper was to try to incorporate the investor feedback into the relevant section. But for the next meeting, you will see a separate paper on the investor feedback, which will have a lot more on what they have told us.
Yan Chao.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I appreciate staff's
paper summary, very clear, very inclusive. I think I learned a lot from your summary. Just a couple of observations and my feeling after reading all the summary of the feedbacks. I got the impression why some stakeholders dislike of the principle developed. It seems that most of them, if this principle, applying this principle, will change their existing practice, especially for those financial instruments already classified as equity. Now they need to reclassify it to be liability when applying new principle. It caused a lot of opposition. This is the first impression I got. So I think we should explore the reason behind that, whether the principle is wrong or right, or whether existing practice really got problem, especially if we are moving towards maybe another financial crisis, and that those financial instruments now classified as equity really will cause problem. If will cause problem, I think we should change the current practice. So we should make sure, and I think we need to do a further research, the amount, the scale, all those things. Secondly, impression I got that it seemed that for some financial instruments, the accounting treatment for those financial instruments in practice do diverge in different jurisdictions, different companies. When I read. So those areas, I think we need to take all those issues. Whatever we do, we should resolve those issues to reduce the divergence. This is why we need to develop standards. Thirdly, it seems that, as I Sue mentioned, that existing IS-32, we got a lot of criticism. It's too complicated, and because there are a lot of exceptions there, fix-to-fix. Some people say it's rule-based, where is the principle? So this is why new financial instruments come out. People don't know how to apply. So this is why if the committee will receive a lot of issues come out. So this means we do need to resolve those problems. How to resolve those problems? Some people don't want to change, but from standard settings perspective, especially I read some of the comments, very helpful, obviously, and also help us how to move forward. Some people are looking at existing practice. Some people are looking at conceptual framework. So what's the next step for us to do? The starting point. Are we going to start from conceptual framework based on existing liability, definition of liability or other relevant requirement? Then based on this concept, develop our principle, maybe based on our two principles, improve further, and using similar term or something like that, and then resolve those problems, existing problems. Ignore those conceptual bases, simply resolve those existing problems. But my impression, past 10 years or 20 years, we try to resolve those practical issues. This is why there are so many exceptions or rule-based requirement there. But at the same time, it doesn't work because people always develop a new financial instrument and try to escape the requirement or try to actually classify those financial instruments as much as possible to be equity instrument in practice. I think it will cause a huge problem if those financial instruments, in some sense, really a liability. So I think already we got conceptual framework there. So I think for me, we're starting from the conceptual framework. And also based on our existing two principles, whether based on this conceptual framework and whether we can develop more clearer principle, and then resolve those problems. If those problems really need to, and worthwhile to resolve, even change the existing practice, but I think from the setting perspective, I think it's worthwhile to do so. So if we do, the practice will change because those contracts eventually will change. Right now, because we got a lot of exceptions and some rule-based requirements, and people try to develop those contracts to meet those requirements, to try to help them to classify those financial instruments, you know, as equity or as they intended, would like, what kind of classification they would like to. So I think I got a lot of idea from the summary, especially some people are looking at those, how to resolve those issues, not only based on our two principles, try to start from our revised conceptual framework. I think it's really helpful, yeah.
Mary?
Some reactions to the paper rather than questions, and they served their purpose in terms of, you know, challenging me to think about, so what do we do next? And some first thoughts just for the staff to go away and consider. I think I put a bunch of considerations in what I'll call the change management bucket. We wanted to do something which was not just here's a list of 7 answers to 10 questions that we've been asked, and, you know, we'll put it in new paragraphs that we put at the end that says, you know, if you have this fact pattern, here's the answer. We were trying with timing and amount to articulate principles in this, you know, in what would become the standard itself, so that not only the practice questions could be answered, but also new practice questions that would come in future, because we'd have kind of this underpinning. And I think one of the change management, you know, themes in the comments is that we were too ambitious if what we were trying to do was targeted changes. Because even if we thought that we were distilling principles that were underlying the thinking and some of the existing requirements, that the process of turning those principles into requirements of a standard would require a wholesale rewrite of many of, at least, the classification requirements in the standard. And so, you know, from a cost perspective, every instrument would have to be reconsidered against the rewritten criteria, not just the ones we identified as being the ones likely to change. And that was a big cost. And so I think that's the sincere message about be less ambitious in what you're trying to do in a targeted project. Now, the reason I use the qualifier sincere is that I think some people were saying that because they didn't like the answers that would come from operationalizing it, as opposed to it's all about change management. But we did intend for this to be targeted changes, and I am a lot more persuaded that operationalizing what we were doing as part of the standard would involve a pretty significant rewrite of IS-32, you know, to make it all hang together. Now, the reason I keep emphasizing in the standard is I think we heard people not liking the consequences that some of it had, but there are relatively few challenges that I picked up, you know, in the letters I've read and in the summaries about the basic timing was supported, as you said, but that it wasn't what are you smoking when we talked about the amount stuff. It was more, we don't like the outcomes on these. We're not sure this is the most relevant information. But they weren't rejecting entirely the notion that this was relevant to users of financial statements, some of the amount features. And I still think if we're trying to develop, if we decide that what we're going to do is try and develop a targeted set, you know, of changes focused primarily on some of the practice issues, I would still use some of the thinking about amount as well as about timing to inform which answer we propose and how we might look at what the relevant information is in specific fact patterns. I'm not sure that'll work, but I think we heard it's too much to incorporate in the standard and require everyone to apply to everything. On the liquidation sorry, I'll make a comment akin to Sue's about look at liquidation, but don't look at liquidation, which is, and this is me whining a bit, you know, you're too ambitious, you're trying to do too much, do targeted, you said you wanted to do targeted, but as long as you're doing targeted, because you also do a few of these other things, like give me some relief on a holder, incorporate the putables exception as a principle, do some of the things around co-op shares more generally, and I think that's real tensions with doing more targeted. So I think if we're going to do targeted, we should really do just targeted rather than the while you're at it, try and do other things. Then moving to the at liquidation focus, I can take the point about the tension with the going concern assumption, and that, you know, was it appropriate, therefore, to reflect it in the classification of a going concern entity's financial statements? I think that there is information for users of financial statements that says if we get to liquidation, shareholders of this instrument have a priority claim on a specified amount of equity. And doing more than perhaps disclosing that or hinting at it in the EPS calculation is I think, important. And maybe we should start thinking about requiring some kind of segregation of equity in terms of, you know, and I'm not talking about our presentation proposal specifically, but I'm talking more narrowly. If we have equity of 100, and it is equity, and I'm, you know, let's say we don't use the liquidation feature to something payable only in liquidation to drive the classification. So we have something as an equity instrument. Say you do know out of this 100 in equity, 60 of it is tagged for those who have a specified claim, you know, via an equity instrument, and it is not equity that is available to the residual shareholders. And that might be another way of addressing some of the concerns that drove us to articulate the amount when it relates to amounts payable only in liquidation. I did have one more group of comments, but they're more about derivatives on own equity. Do they belong now or do they belong? Okay. I think we just cannot move off the notion that the liability for a forward or a put on your own equity has to be at the gross amount, because going back to the timing feature for which there was widespread acceptance, that is the amount that can be taken and what you're going to get back is something that you can report as an asset. So to net off the value at any point in time of the shares that you would get back against your payment obligation is, I think, inconsistent with the timing feature. It's a straight requirement to distribute resources of the entity. So I think we cannot back off of that. But I do then have some sympathy with those who were looking at some of the consequences when we were trying to line up economically similar instruments and say, you know, you have to de-reckon, this is where I think I'm getting into one of the other papers, de-recognize shares that remain outstanding in order to get consistent presentation of put rights that are in different forms. And maybe we have to think a bit more also about the interaction with treasury share accounting, because I think people raised a number of practical, but they relate back to conceptual concerns about what happens if you de-recognize shares that are outstanding and participate as outstanding shares in, some people raise voting, but I'm thinking about mundane things like dividend distributions or getting additional shares in share distributions, et cetera. And so maybe we have to, again, go back and think about that a bit more. So those are kind of some of the high-level reactions that I had to this feedback, but I think it was a very good way of breaking it up in terms of saying, remember, here's what we're talking about in this area, here are the concerns, here's the main feedback. And it allows us, I think, to digest things as well as we can in a challenging topic.
Any other comments?
And see up paper 5D.
In paper 5D, we summarise the detailed feedback received from comment letters and outreach for stakeholders on question 6 in section 5 of the DP. So the first part of question 6 relates to compound instruments, for example, convertible bonds, and redemption obligation arrangements, for example, own shares and a written put option on own shares. And both of these arrangements include derivatives on own equity, either standalone or embedded, and they involve alternative settlement outcomes that are not controlled by the issuer entity. Nearly two-thirds of respondents who sent comment letters provided feedback to this part of the question. The second part of question 6 relates to financial instruments that also involve alternative settlement outcomes, but this time they are controlled by the entity. So these are your reverse convertible bonds or shares that are callable by the issuer entity. And over a third of respondents who sent comment letters provided feedback to this part of the question. So in paragraph 4 of the paper, we summarise the proposals in section 5 of the DP. But the key messages that we heard are as follows. So generally, respondents welcomed the board's efforts to address the accounting diversity for compound instruments, and in particular NCI puts. A few respondents noted, however, that the preferred approach for compound instruments and redemption obligations seems to be overly complex, so that is more complex than the current requirements in IS 32. For redemption obligation arrangements, many respondents agreed that the basis for the assessment should be the package of contractual rights and obligations. However, some respondents suggested that the board define what is meant by package of contractual rights and obligations, and how to determine when the combined unit of account should be applied. Respondents expressed mixed views on the proposed accounting for redemption obligation arrangements, including NCI puts, and this was largely based on whether or not they believed that own shares and written put on own shares was fundamentally and economically different from a convertible bond. So most respondents expressed concerns about the proposed derecognition of own shares, particularly when they represent NCI, and the potential impacts on the consolidated financial statements. And this was regardless of whether they broadly agreed or disagreed with the board's preliminary views. So in this regard, many respondents highlighted or raised questions on the impacts of the DP's proposals on other IFRS standards, like IFRS 10, IFRS 3, and IS 33, which we discuss in paragraphs 45 to 55 of the paper. In their response to the questions related to financial instruments with alternative settlement outcomes that are controlled by the entity, most respondents agreed that the board should address the issue, and most of them were in favour of enhanced disclosures about the alternative settlement outcomes rather than trying to separate embedded derivatives from the equity host instrument. Of those respondents that agreed that the board should address the issue, most agreed that such a financial instrument is classified as equity in its entirety. However, some respondents did not agree with equity classification and suggested other approaches for the board to consider. For example, approaches that would take into consideration the impact of economic compulsion and indirect obligations. So I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members.
Thanks, Angie. Like Mary, I didn't see anything in the responses that made me rethink the general idea, which was in the DP, which is consistent with 32 today, about the grossing up of things subject to puts. The thing that did puzzle me a little bit in the comments, because I personally hadn't thought it was that different to what we do today, but it seems to have got a lot of attention, so I'd interested to understand it better, is the concerns raised on the unit of account and this package of contractual rights and obligations, because already today, if I had shares on issue and I had a put, in effect you look at the package when you look at the accounting for the package, for the shares.
That's right.
So I didn't really think it was that much of a change, but I don't know whether it was the way we phrased it or because we were focused more on the similarities with convertibles that they reacted.
I think it's both of that, and it's also when we proposed the equity instrument is derecognized, I think that made people think more about, okay, so now it became more clearer to them what's included in the package, and that made them question, when do I apply this concept and when do I apply, when I don't apply them.
On the comments on the derecognition aspects of it, I think it would be good to think through in more detail what those sort of day two accounting mechanics look like, to make sure that either to agree with them that it's a step too far, or to give ourselves and others comfort that the logic hangs together. Personally, I've always thought that it does follow through, but I've spent too many years thinking about 32. But I understand people's points, because I think our logic is that, in a sense, once you've got shares with a put on issue at the same time, you're really saying those shares aren't on issue anymore, and then everything follows through accordingly. Now, I know that that then creates disconnects, because the legal reality is you've got a thing outstanding as a matter of law that you're paying dividends on it and all of this sort of stuff. So I think we need to think through and explain why it makes sense. It also, I think, means we do need to answer this question about, if you've got something on the balance sheet that's classified as a liability, but then you pay a discretionary amount on it, how does that thing get accounted for as a dividend or as interest? And we sort of sidestep that question, so I think that's important as well. Also, I think the other thing that we need to think through carefully, and this only dawned on me relatively late in the project and the drafting process, is the fact that when we're talking about things that can be put, that in some circumstances it's stuff that's got sort of variable share settlement elements, so you don't actually know definitely how many shares would be derecognised, or indeed whether you'll end up derecognising shares as opposed to issuing new shares because of the net settlement mechanics, and whether we're really comfortable with that derecognition analysis following through even for those types of instruments. And so I think we'd need to spend some time on that. But overall, I thought the feedback was interesting, but it's the day two questions that were the more interesting for me. I was pleased that people mainly seemed to agree with our logic in terms of the sort of reverse convertible bond type instruments rather than wanting us to gross up.
Mary?
2 points. One is in paper 5D, paragraph 30, where you're reporting a few respondents disagreed with a gross obligation, including derecognition. I think when you're analyzing, or, you know, going back to those, it might be useful to separate out their comments about, I don't like it because of derecognition, mm-hmm. versus I don't like it because of a gross obligation, or I don't like it because of the debit and equity. You know, trying to see if when you go back and look at those comments, if you can tell if it was all those things or if it was one aspect of that was driving their feedback, that there may be nuances in there that could be helpful for us in thinking about a way forward. And the other is just mentioning the elephant in the room is, you know, one of the big things with the more ambitious version of this project that we were looking for timing and amount to do is to take some of the pressure off economic compulsion. And if we don't pursue a full-fledged version of that, what if anything we want to do or don't want to do? But I think we have to go back and revisit that question about the line that exists today that we propose to keep between economic incentives and in substance obligations.
Thank you.
No further questions. Tuck, sorry.
Just quickly about NCI put. Especially there are lots of argument about derecognition of the equity portion. And I read the debate. I found the debate very interesting because there is a conflict between IFRS 9 and IFRS 10. So between the two. But my question is there any constructive comment of which proposing that in such a cases it is more like IFRS 9, and in such a cases it is more like IFRS 10, and separate different accounting. So I read in paragraph 33, we shouldn't need to be consistent or different accounting is necessary. So I was wondering if there was some constructive suggestion or comment to separate NCI put differently?
I don't think there was something that was supported or echoed by at least some respondents. I think there was some suggestion about how they see things, but I don't think there were like comprehensive solution that was proposed on that in that regard.
Okay. No further questions? No?
There's one more.
One more paper. One paper?
Yes. Okay, agenda paper 5E. So in this paper, we summarize the detailed feedback received from comment letters and outreach for stakeholders on question 4 of the DP, which deals with the puttable exception in IS32. The puttable exception requires issuers to classify financial instruments with particular features as equity, even though they meet the definition of a financial liability. And we received feedback on this issue from over 80% of all respondents that sent comment letters. This paper also summarizes the detailed feedback received from comment letters and outreach on instruments in the scope of IFRIC 2, which we refer to in the paper as IFRIC 2 instruments or members' shares or cooperative shares. And as noted in paragraph 41 of the paper, IFRIC 2 instruments have specific features which are consistent with the specific objectives of cooperatives. And these instruments are classified as equity, for example, if the issuer has the unconditional right to refuse redemption or redemption is unconditionally prohibited by regulation. So in developing the DP, the board decided not to reconsider that interpretation nor apply the analysis in that interpretation more broadly. And we received feedback related to the classification of IFRIC 2 instruments from approximately 10% of all respondents that sent comment letters. So the key messages we heard are as follows. Most of the respondents to question 4 in the DP agreed with retaining the puttable exception. However, many of these still believe that including an exception undermines the board's principle-based approach to standard setting. Some respondents disagreed with retaining the puttable exception, and they suggested some alternative approaches that would overcome the need for the puttable exception. Some respondents that agreed with retaining the puttable exception highlighted application issues arising in practice, for example, relating to identifying the most subordinate instrument or determining whether puttable instruments have identical features. And they recommended the board provide guidance to address those application challenges. A few respondents that disagreed with retaining the puttable exception suggested the board undertake further work to establish the extent to which the puttable exception is used in practice, the application challenges arising from it, and whether potential improvements could be identified before deciding whether to retain the puttable exception. Some respondents considered the impact of the puttable exception on the classification of financial assets in IFRS 9 from the holder's perspective, and they encouraged the board to assess whether the classification criteria from the holder's perspective should be the same as from the issuer's perspective. Almost all the respondents that commented on the classification of IFRIC 2 instruments said that they strongly supported the requirements of IFRIC 2 being carried forward unchanged and believed that cooperative shares that meet the IFRIC 2 conditions and represent the most subordinated instrument should be classified as equity under any classification approach. Some respondents were concerned that the board's proposals with respect to the amount feature would affect the equity classification outcome of IFRIC 2 instruments, especially if the amount payable on liquidation is independent of the entity's available economic resources. So I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members.
See, the board members are still have a lot of energy. No questions? Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.